When we talk about pollinators, we're not just talking about honeybees. Today, the pollinators of Iowa, bees, wasps, flies, and butterflies, the important work they do and the dangers they face. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. One out of every three bites of food that we put in our mouths has been made possible by pollinators. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be here to talk about our native pollinators and honeybees. Then later on, ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh will stop in to answer your questions about the plants in your life. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. It's also National Pollinator Week. And to celebrate that, we have entomologist Donald Lewis from Iowa State University Extension here today. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. What's the buzz?
Well, and we've heard a lot about pollinators recently. This is National Pollinator Week, but pollinators have been in the news pretty consistently for the last several years, and not just honeybees, right? I mean, we spend a lot of time talking about honeybees and the plight of honeybees, but there are many other pollinators that also need to be part of this conversation.
Yes, yes, indeed. And since 2006, on the action of the U.S. Senate, we have had this week in June where we are supposed to focus on pollinators, but it seems like the message has become much more diverse than that and much more broad than that, and pollinators are in the news quite a bit. Pollinators get mixed up with monarch butterflies, and it's kind of hard to tell which one we're talking about sometime, but it's always the same story. We have changed the habitat around us to the point that these insects that were depending on a variety of flowers and forbs and other plants are struggling. And what can we do to bring those back? And so that's the focus of National Pollinator Week. Bring back the pollinators.
And of course, every time we talk about pollinators, we talk about this, but I still think it's worth talking about because it's so striking how much of our lives are touched by pollinators. Can you give us the big picture?
Well, as you said in the opening, the estimate is that one out of every three mouthfuls of food comes from a plant that required some sort of a pollinator. Yes, you mentioned bees, but also the butterflies, hummingbirds, even bats, beetles, ants, flies are involved in this process of moving pollen from the male part of a flower to the female part of a flower. And the bees and the butterflies and the wasps and the beetles are not doing that for our benefit. They're doing it for their own benefit because they're visiting those flowers to get nectar and pollen, a food source that is their reward for doing what the flowers have to depend on them to do. Now, when we think of pollination and you look out your window and you see all those millions of acres of corn and soybeans, you wonder, who's doing that? Well, in many crops, gravity will take care of distributing the pollen. But for many of our food crops, particularly when you start thinking of fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and forage crops, somebody else has to come along and carry that pollen, and that's where the pollinators come in.
All right. And in Iowa, when we think about pollinators, what should we be thinking about other than those honeybees?
Certainly bumblebees come to mind, but when you talk about managed pollinators, which pollinator can I physically move around the countryside, put it where I want it, when I want it? It really boils down to honeybees. The European honeybee that was brought to the United States by the colonists is the workhorse of pollination services because we can move them like livestock. We can pick them up from wherever they are, put them in the apple orchard when we need them, take them out of the apple orchard when we don't need them. So honeybees get all that attention. But before there were honeybees, there were all these other bees. Bumblebees are certainly in that category of pollinators, and they're buzz pollinators for many different plants. But then we get down into some little tiny solitary bees. And these are bees that don't make colonies. They don't live in a hive. Each female works by herself to make a little nest that she provisions with nectar and pollen and where she lays her eggs. When I talk about these solitary bees, the light comes on in people's eyes when I say, think of sweat bees. It just seems like people understand there are these other little bees that are fairly brightly colored, and many of us grew up calling them sweat bees, and that's what we're talking about for these other pollinator bees that are have always been there and the ones we're now trying to encourage.
And sweat bees aren't just one kind of bee.
It's hundreds or thousands of species of these little tiny bees. Some of them nest in the ground, and that's where they provision nectar and pollen to raise their offspring. Some of them live in hollow stems. Some of them are big. Oddly enough, they're called the large green sweat bees. Some of them are small, and those are called the small green sweat bees. And we're into dozens of species just by talking about those two major groups. Then we get into another group of bees where the males have incredibly long antennae. Those are referred to as the long-horned bees. If you're a melon grower, you're depending on squash bee. There's lots and lots of these out there that get very little attention until we start looking for them and thinking about them specifically.
And the honeybees being our sort of livestock bee, the bees that we depend on in agriculture to get all of this pollination work done, we have been talking a lot about how colony collapse has been affecting bees and how other, you know, things in the environment may be killing off bees. Are the native pollinators also being affected by the same things that seem to be affecting honeybees?
Yes, indeed. And especially bumblebee decline now has been dramatic and has been documented that we may have only a fourth of the bumblebees that we used to have. They used to be much more common. And like colony collapse disorder or like the decline in honeybees, there doesn't appear to be one problem. It's a complex of problems, starting with lack of habitat, lack of food resources, and the food resources they have may not be very good for them. So the pollinators are weakened by not getting enough to eat, and then they may be exposed to pesticides as a kind of a final blow. And what we keep finding is it's not one thing that's causing these declines in pollinators and butterflies. It's all of these together. And then the question becomes, well, which one of those can we change? And pesticides frequently come to the top, like as the simple solution to a very complex problem. Let's just stop using insecticides. And of course, there are no simple answers to complex problems.
Do we know more about what pesticides may be interacting with our pollinators now than we did? I mean, there seem to be so many studies that come out and everybody says, oh, aha, we found the answer. And then somebody else says, no, we didn't.
Yeah.
So do we know more? Do we know what kinds of pesticides are causing some of these deaths?
We keep learning little bits and pieces. And of course, I've been in this long enough to remember when we used to use chlorinated hydrocarbon insecticides that stank terribly. They were just these smelly things, and they were highly toxic, and we worried about exposure to those. And we eliminated them by getting less toxic insecticides, which were then eliminated to get even less toxic insecticides, always looking at mammalian toxicity. What can we get that will be safer, lower toxicity to the applicators and to the people who might be exposed and to wildlife? We got down to insecticides that are virtually non-toxic to us, that we have moved from things that were highly toxic to insecticides that are virtually non-toxic, only to find that they move through the plant. They work very well at very low doses at killing insect pests, but unfortunately they also move into the nectar and pollen and are then exposed to the pollinators and the nectar and pollen feeders that are visiting the flowers. So it's kind of this funny story in a way. It seems ironic that we kept getting insecticides that were less and less toxic to us, but as we always say, you can't do one thing. The ones we're using now, the neonicotinoid insecticides, are potentially more toxic to pollinators that are feeding on the flowers.
All right, so we don't have all of the final answers on that, although we are learning more. What can we do right now to try to support the wild pollinators that we do have?
Well, places like the Pollinator Partnership and the Xerces Society are heavily involved in putting out information that people can use. It's a tremendous uphill battle to think about the upper Midwest, where 125 million acres of prairie, diverse habitat, was replaced with monocultures of corn and soybeans. And how are we going to overcome that loss of diversity Well, the answer is we start putting it back wherever we can, in whatever scale we can. So in your backyard, you can create a pollinator garden. In the corner of a fence row in a field, you can let milkweeds and other pollinator plants grow. In small measure, we can start putting back biodiversity. And I think that's the answer in one word. If people say, what can I do? Biodiversity. What can you put back that these insects and other pollinators will be able to use?
With a lot of wildlife, we talk about islands of habitat and how habitat needs to be continuous so that wild creatures can get from one area to another. Mm-hmm. With pollinators, does that matter? Does an island of habitat help?
I think it's going to help a little bit. And the other way to look at it is what we can do. And if we all start doing our point, and that's our part, and that's another point to make about Pollinator Appreciation Week, is that we're in these educational efforts to try to encourage others to do more as well. My little plot of flowers by itself may not make much of a difference, but if I can get a whole neighborhood to do that, then these isolated islands become less severe. And I think, yes, when we're talking about mega fauna, the large wildlife that has to have large tracks, maybe these islands are a little more detrimental, but I think insects get around quite well. They blow quite well on the breeze. They fly quite readily. I think they'll find the resource wherever we hide it.
Now, we do also see these articles that come out that tell us, you know, honeybees will be entirely gone in 25 years or something like that. When you read stuff like that, what do you think?
Well, I think overstatement, exaggeration, hyperbole is one of the ways we grab attention. That if I told you, you know, there's this little problem with honeybees, it might not gather much attention. It might not get much action. But if I start shouting that honeybees are going to go and you're going to starve to death, suddenly you might pay more attention. It's not a nice way to treat friends and neighbors, to yell hyperbole at them. But committed activists are how things get done. And sometimes they sound a little more exaggerated than what I think would be justified, but they're on a mission to improve the system, and we have to support them where we can. And who knows? Maybe they'll be right. I'm not that pessimistic. My glass is still half full, and we're going to have pollinators well into the future.
And do you feel like things are moving in the right direction as far as seeing people creating habitat?
Maybe we have bottomed out, and it's because of all the attention. There's a whole lot more research on pollinators and honeybees and monarch butterflies than there used to be. There's a lot more press. There are all these websites. I think we bottomed out, and it's uphill from here.
All right, and there are a number of events this weekend to celebrate National Pollinator Week. Ryman Gardens is hosting its first annual Pollinator Fest from 10 to 2 on Saturday. There's also, at pretty much the same time, the Pollinator Fest at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge. So there are lots of opportunities to celebrate pollinators this coming weekend. Donald Lewis is with me, entomologist from Iowa State University Extension. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back to talk about the plants and insects in your life. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we have an incredible amount of knowledge and talent on the show with us today. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh is here. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
And, of course, you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send your questions by email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Richard, we've had a lot of moisture. Mm-hmm. Are you starting to get calls about moisture-related problems?
Not too much. We're seeing some anthracnose on some of the trees, like the sycamore. That's pretty common. They'll be fine, but for the most part, not a great deal, no.
All right, that's good. I mean, there hasn't been flooding, which is...
For the most part, not too much.
We are getting more calls about mosquitoes thanks to the abundant rain, so that's one thing that is up. Interestingly, mosquitoes are not yet as abundant as they were at this time last year when we had sort of a similar pattern of a heavy rainfall in the springtime, so we'll have to wait and see how much more rain we get to see how much higher the mosquito population goes.
And susceptible crab apples are actually starting to show some apple scab on their leaves, and we are starting to get some light yellowing and leaf drop. So probably by July 4th or the middle of July, some people will be losing a lot of leaves on their crab apples.
All right. So there has been quite a bit of moisture, right? Well, and Donald, when people call you about mosquitoes, what do they call to say? We're expecting them every year, aren't we?
Well, we should. We live in Iowa. We live in the potholed area of the upper Midwest. And when it rains, when water impoundments last for a week to 10 days, yes, mosquitoes reproduce and they do quite well. Oftentimes, people ask what they can do on their own. They ask about their own backyard. Sometimes it's very specific. I have a June wedding in my backyard. What can I do? Sometimes it's looking for a little help to rattle the political will to get the city to do something about my mosquitoes. So it's a variety of questions, but oftentimes it comes down to, unless your city is managing the mosquito population for you, in your own backyard, you can make a temporary dent in the population using various kinds of insecticides for mosquitoes, but your best bet still remains using personal repellents when you have to be working outside and the mosquitoes are abundant.
All right. And we do have our first phone call is probably a moisture-related question as well. And again, you can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Daisy is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Daisy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your question?
My question is, what to do to get rid of mushrooms growing in my front yard? I am told related to rain, but what am I going to, I am the only one in the block growing the mushrooms.
Okay, well,
anything I can do?
You're lucky. as far as the mushrooms, you can pick and discard them.
That's what I do.
But you can't put anything on the ground to prevent them from coming back up.
Oh,
so they'll come. So they'll come back up periodically when the environment is favorable, typically when it's cool and moist. But all you can do is basically pick and discard them when they show up.
All right. And if she picks and discards them before they release their spores, does that help to control things a little bit?
Not really.
Okay.
Because they're basically the fruiting body of the fungus that's in the ground that's decaying organic matter, typically tree roots and things like that. And so they typically go ahead and produce these reproductive structures, but they'll still be there regardless. So they'll be around possibly for several years.
All right, Daisy, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's an email from Sherry. She says, last night I was mowing the lawn and I stirred up quite a few moths that were nestled within the blades of grass. Is this a precursor indicating army worms are coming?
Well, it indicates the army worm moths are already here. And I agree. It's there with this last storm, and I don't know if it came from the west or the south, armyworm moths were blown in tremendous abundance. And armyworm moths are tan in color. When they land, they are definitely an elongated triangular shape. And the body is about an inch to an inch and a quarter length. So it's a big moth. It's easy to identify by its triangular shape and its tan color. And we always have armyworm moths, but in my 38 years of experience here in the state of Iowa, three times I have heard of an armyworm outbreak in a home lawn. Now, armyworms are occasionally a problem in no-till cornfields, and farmers know how to deal with that and how to inspect for it. But the concern for a homeowner is that all these moths are going to lay eggs, all those eggs will turn into caterpillars, and they will mow your grass down to the soil level by clipping it off as they march along in a column, much like an army would march forward. This just doesn't happen. We get the moths, but rarely do we ever get the outbreak. Now, for those who are still not sure what moth we're talking about, go to a linden tree tonight. Look up at the blooms, and you'll see these clouds of moths feeding on the nectar from linden flowers, which are in bloom right now, at least here in Ames. So that's the other place to look for them, is at flowering plants.
Sherry's follow-up question was, what can I do to treat my lawn that won't hurt the pollinators or the birds? It sounds like you're saying, don't do anything.
Don't do anything. The moths will never hurt you. The adult stage is harmless and can't hurt a thing. What we would watch for are striped, orangey, greenish-colored caterpillars that are chewing the grass blades down to the bare bare soil. And if those caterpillars appear, all you have to do is spray that spot where the caterpillars are feeding with soapy water or a traditional insecticide. If you do that while they're small, the insecticidal soap will work very well. So wait and watch. Keep looking for caterpillars defoliating your lawn. Treat the spot if necessary. Don't spray the entire lawn.
All right. The number to call, 866-780-9100. You can call with your plant questions, your tree questions, your insect questions today. Tom is up next in Des Moines. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Hello, Charity. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I'm back on the pollinators again. I've seen very few of them this summer, bees or butterflies or anything. And I'm just wondering how much research is being done on GMOs. I understand that they've created them so that they can be doused with Roundup or other pesticides. And then the neonicotinoids. I'm just a little fearful that we're getting close to Rachel Carson's Silent Spring because, you know, the pollinators and the bees and the butterflies are fed on by the birds and the birds. You know, it's mm-hmm. the web of life, and it worries me a bit.
Well, and it worries a lot of people to the point that the monarch butterfly has been promoted to the National Wildlife Federation and to the federal government for classification as a threatened species because of the loss of habitat and the lack of milkweeds. A study done a few years ago indicated that 85% of the milkweeds that used to grow in the upper Midwest are gone, not because of GMO corn that's again that is effective against insect pests, but because of the Roundup Ready factor that we now spray these fields with Roundup, and the milkweeds that used to grow in the soybean fields and the corn fields are killed early on in the development. So it's that lack of food that seems to be a huge part of it, and the monarch butterfly population in Mexico in the last couple of years, overwintering population is 1/20th of what it used to be. So there's a dramatic decline, and it's gaining a lot of attention, and it appears to be largely related to habitat with these other stresses thrown in as well. So, yes, it's catching attention, and we're hoping awareness, we're hoping education can help reverse that trend.
Tom, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This one's from Ann in Iowa City. Some foliage in my flower and vegetable gardens is being eaten away. My hollyhock leaves are barely visible, or a barely visible lace of veins. There are numerous holes in the foliage of hibiscus, grape, and eggplant. There's a smaller amount of damage to the potatoes and a little bit on the green beans. I don't see any bugs. What do you recommend?
Live with it is my recommendation. That's a whole lot of different host plants that each would have to have a different insect. I can't think of any insect short of the Japanese beetle, which has not been reported yet this summer.
And she would see those.
Yeah, they're large. They're
right.
They're 5/8 of an inch long. The one that I can think of a specific example to a specific insect to blame would be the hollyhock weevil that feeds on hollyhock leaves may have caused that. But that was done earlier in the season. It's a fairly tiny weevil, so you may not actually even see that. Otherwise, my guess is it's a conglomeration of problems, maybe some insects, maybe some weather damage, maybe some unfortunate weather at the time of leaf emergence. Ooh, help me out here, Richard. What else could be going on that variety of plants?
Well, when you're talking about hollyhocks, the foliage is rarely very attractive. you typically have things like rust, insect damage. The flowers are very attractive.
It's
but
all
often,
about the flowers.
It's all about the flowers because the foliage typically is kind of ratty looking oftentimes. So you kind of admire them from a distance where you don't really see the foliage.
otherwise, keep looking, and we'll just shoot the bottom line one more time. If you don't see an insect pest, an insecticide will not help. So just keep that insecticide in the bag, in the bottle, until you see armyworms defoliating your lawn, until you see insects on the trees and shrubs or on the flowers that have been mentioned. That's one of the ways we protect pollinators is not spraying when it won't do any good. We've been guilty of that in the past, and we're trying to get out of that habit.
To add to that, Donald, is sometimes even the level of damage, like you're just mentioning, is not bad enough to even justify spraying, even if you do see them.
Right. Some people are pretty picky about the foliage on their plants, and a few holes are so offensive, it's almost as if it happened to them personally. They feel attacked by it. So, yes, tolerance is another way. Tolerance of some insect damage is another way to help the pollinators.
All right, let's get back to the phones and go to a question in Grimes. Is it Pamode?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question about a red maple tree.
Okay, what's your question?
It suddenly seems to be dying. It was just fine over the last weekend, and since Monday I noticed the leaves wilting, and now I'm looking at it and it's just pretty much all the leaves are gone.
Is this a newly planted tree?
No, this has been, the tree has been here since almost 5 years now.
It's been there 5 years.
Yeah.
Has there been any site changes or anything unusual happen around that tree?
Nothing that I can think of.
One thing you may want to look at, is it something that you planted?
Yes, we planted this five, 6 years ago.
As Richard mentioned a little bit, there's a couple things out there. There is a disease called anthracnose that we do see on maple, ash, and others, but usually that's only going to attack individual leaves. The other thing that, and usually it doesn't affect the whole tree or at a large scale, the other thing with maples, there is a disease called verticillium wilt, and it will often start on individual branches and then start to go throughout the plant. Or sometimes just take individual branches out and not take the whole tree. Sometimes I've noticed in years where we've had extreme moisture, it's actually a root-borne disease that if we have a lot of moisture in the soil, sometimes that organism seems to do better. But it usually can start with individual branches. So that's one possibility. The other thing is, I would look at the way that tree is sitting in the soil or sitting in the ground. If it doesn't have much of a flare at the roots, sometimes we get concerned about planting depth. And that can be something that shows up 5 years, 10 years, 12 years later, and sometimes it can cause some dieback. So the first thing I would look for is to see if I dig around the trunk of that tree a little bit to see if I have any major roots fairly close to the ground. If I don't, then I would be concerned about planting depth. The other is just to look at the pattern, and if there's individual branches wilting, you may want to take a sample into the county extension office to see if potentially verticillium wilt could be part of the issue.
And if planting depth is a problem, what can you do about it at this point?
The first thing you can do is try to find those first lateral roots and then slowly pull that soil away. Again, they have to be covered up, but if they're 3, 4, or 5 inches, you can try to bowl that out and just see if that helps with adjustment. But if it's been in the ground for 5 years, you're usually not going to be able to reset that tree.
Right.
So sometimes it can continue to go south.
And if you pull the soil out, will you have like a pooling or puddling problem when it rains?
You could. So it's a challenge. The funny thing is, I think there's a good chance that may not be the issue. It could be verticillium or something like that, because typically with planting depth, it usually shows up in the spring and the trees don't leaf out very well, or in the fall, they start to lose their fall color earlier than normal, and then they do that continuously year after year. They just don't start wilting. So if we're getting wilting, we may have something like verticillium wilt. Do you have anything to add to that, Richard?
No.
Other than, yes, a sample can be taken to the county extension office, or you could send Richard a picture of your tree. Usually it takes about two pictures, one that shows the entire tree, one that shows the base of the tree, including the ground around it. You can email digital images to Richard, and sometimes we can get a better guess, but it may come back the same answer. We don't know it up and died.
Now, if you're sending a sample to the plant diagnostic clinic, what you want to do is go out there and maybe prune off two or three small branches that are clearly showing the symptoms of wilting, but they should be live branches that are beginning to wilt. Put those in a plastic bag, okay, and keep the specimen cool, and then maybe send those directly to the plant diagnostic clinic here at Iowa State.
Okay, thank you. This looks like something systemic because it's from the top to the bottom, every leaf, every branch. Mm. And it's like something that completely was off water for like several months. It's just suddenly in the last 3 days, 4 days.
Okay. Mm. Yep. We'll do what we can to help you with samples or digital images. And you can find our website at Iowa State University for the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic.
All right.
And you'll be in line with lots of other dead maples, by the way.
Pemo, thank you so much for your call. And we're just about to go to a break. Larry in Ames wants to ask you, Donald. He says, I have 18 large ant colonies in my yard. What should I do?
Love them. Ants are beneficial. But when the ant colonies get too large, you can rake the soil down, sprinkle it with an insecticide, just treating the anthill. That will not make them go away. You can set them back, and you may have to do it again.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron is here. And DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh is here. We've got a couple phone lines open for your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron, DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh, and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. So you can call us with your plant questions, your bug questions, or your tree questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Our email address, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Charlotte is on the line from Charles City. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, we have a number of apple trees in our small orchard, and none of them bloomed this year. My son also has an apple tree, and it didn't bloom. And I have a cousin who says he has 8 apple trees, and he said he'll be lucky to get a pie out of all these 8. I'm wondering, is this a common phenomenon this year, and what could cause that?
I would say it's not common. First of all, as far as why they would not bloom, one is age. When you plant an apple tree, they have to grow and mature.
Tree.
Okay, right. And so when you plant an apple tree, oftentimes they don't begin to flower for maybe 4 to 5 years. That's perfectly normal. And in fact, you should not allow them to produce fruit for at least 2 or 3 years so they can grow first. So age is typically the main thing. Once they get to a certain size, then they can begin to flower and bear fruit.
All right. And also, it can be a problem on the other side, too, where you have too many apples on the trees, right?
Right, right. Once you get a tree to the producing stage, then at that point, if they flower heavily and bear heavily, you need to go out there and hand thin some of the fruit. And you need to typically do that within 30 days of bloom. If you don't do that, they just can't do everything. The flower buds actually begin to form in late summer. But if they're producing a heavy crop, they just cannot set flowers too, so you don't have anything the next year.
All right, let's go back to an email question. This one's from Sarah. Rose slugs attacked my roses earlier this year. I never treated for them, and the new foliage appears to be unaffected. Do rose slugs die off as the season progresses? Should I still treat my rose?
Rose slug is a sawfly. We're talking about a type of insect, not a true slug. And they are present in the month of May. They're little green larvae on the underside of the leaf. They frequently skeletonize roses, and it seems like climbers are usually a little more affected than hybrid tea roses. And they're there in the month of May. They feed, they develop, they drop to the ground, they go away, and there are no rose slug sawflies until the following year. So it's one and done for this insect, and that's why the new growth appears unaffected. If you didn't treat back in early May to control the sawfly slugs on the bottom side of the plant, it's too late to do anything. You just appreciate what you've got and watch the new foliage come out normal.
All right. Here's another email question. This one, it says, I have 4 dappled willows on the north side of my house.
Okay.
The previous 2 years, they've done wonderfully. This year, there are big brown patches in several. What might the problem be, and what should I do? Can I prune out the dead branches?
Right. Well, willows are willows, and as such, they do have a number of insect and disease problems, so it's pretty common to see some dieback in them. I'm not sure exactly what it would be. It might be a canker or something of that nature. But basically, if you have some dead in it, I would just simply prune it out.
And to identify cankers, what they need to do is just look for sunken areas, or often they're discolored, especially with willows. Those cankers will be sometimes vibrant. You know, if it's the twig is green, there'll be a black or even an orange, and that area will be indented or sunken, and there will often be boundaries around that. So often, if you find those cankers, then cut back to the live material behind those cankers.
All right, and here's an email from Reed. I've been looking for alternatives to neonicotinoid pesticides for my flowers and vegetables. One suggestion I've seen is to use neem oil. Do your guests have any experience using this? Is it safe for pollinators?
Neem oil is a botanical insecticide. It comes from a tree that grow. It comes from the nuts of a tree that grow in India, called azadirachtin. So when you see neem oil, or azadirect, or azadirachtin, we're all talking about the same thing. Because it's botanical, it has a good reputation. It has some limitations in the home garden, and one of those limitations is it is a growth regulator type of insecticide and not a traditional poison. So if you spray it on an adult, fully grown insect, you would not expect any effect. But if you sprayed it on a larva or a nymph that was still growing, you would expect that insect to not finish its development. You would expect it to stop there. So in that regard, it's useful for some things like aphids and beetle larvae and some other insects that are still in their immature stage. But it would be worthless, for example, if you have Japanese beetles feeding on your roses, because those are already fully grown adults. So with that limitation, neem oil is effective. You usually have to apply it earlier in the development of an insect than many people find. But yes, as a substitute for neonicotinoids, it's going to have some application, but it's not going to be as broad spectrum as the other insecticides.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Judy is on the line in Martinsdale. Hi, Judy.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question is about deer flies. It seems that for the first time this year, when I am mowing, even though I have gloves on, these deer flies attack me and give me a really good hearty bite.
Yep.
And I was wondering what I might use to either repel them or control them.
Well, you're not going to control deer flies or black flies or buffalo gnats. There's several different things that come into this category of biting flies that don't bite daintily. They don't bite gently. They slash the skin open, and then they slurp up the blood through the wound. These are coming from a wide variety of habitats. For example, the black flies are coming out of running water. Deer flies may have been coming out of swampy, marshy, wet soil areas. We just can't find enough habitats to treat to eliminate them. And, of course, if we did treat those habitats, something unintended would happen as well. So we're not going to eliminate their breeding sources. Unfortunately, repellents that were developed specifically for mosquitoes don't work very well. So you can try repellents, the common ones like Picaridin and DEET and others, to see if it gets you some relief, but don't have too high of expectations. Long sleeves, gloves.
Hats with floppy brims.
All those things help. What do the foresters do for deer flies, Mark?
Keep walking.
Keep walking. Yep, hope for a breeze. Yep, this is one that there's just no easy answer, because they come from long distances, they feed for a brief period, and yes, turn up your shirt collar like Uncle Ralph used to do when he walked through the woods. There's just no easy answer.
All right, Judy, sorry. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Michael is on the line next from Clear Lake. Hi, Michael.
Hello. We've got Japanese lilac trees in our parkway that we put in a few years ago. Some are doing well, others not so much. They've lost a lot of leaves, and wondering what the problem might be.
What kind of symptoms do they have? Do they have spotting of the foliage, browning, yellowing, anything?
No leaves.
No leaves, yeah.
No leaves.
A lot of branches.
Okay, so Did they develop then fall off, or they just didn't develop?
The first couple of years they were fine, and now they've just every year when they come back, the poor trees just have fewer and fewer leaves and more dead branches.
I would start to look, kind of going back to planting depth or maybe the site and stuff like that. Usually if a tree each year is not, if it continues to kind of decline, even if it hasn't been in the ground very long, there could be something specifically, even if they're in strip plantings, one area might be a little damper than the other. Look for patterns where there just may be issues for those individual plants, because kind of what you're describing is that they're leafing out worse and worse each year. So often that's not always a disease or an insect. It could be site-related, or those plants are having issues. They could be getting hit with mowers. I mean, there could be a combination of things.
Very good. Thanks for your help.
All right, Michael, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Mildred is on the line in Algona. Hi, Mildred.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, we have houseplants in our south window, but we also like to watch the birds out that window. But anytime somebody moves, the birds all fly away. So I was wondering if it would hurt the houseplants if we put that stuff on the windows that lets you see out, but you can't see in.
Oh, interesting question. Richard?
I don't believe it will, because I think it blocks certain types of light, but not the light that the plants would use.
Good.
Yeah. Of course, what you could do is answer the question for us by putting it on one window and not the other, and put plants on both sides, and call us back in 2 years and tell us which plants did the best.
There's four windows.
Oh, well, two and two, maybe. Right?
Replicated studies.
Now, I will say most houseplants don't need direct sun either. So as long as they get bright light, they're usually okay.
Okay, good.
All right, Mildred, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, good luck with that. Next up, we have Chris in Milford. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Carrie. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
I have read, this is about pollinators, that if you buy perennials or annuals at a big box store, that they have already been sprayed with some insecticide for some reason. I don't know why. And I'm wondering if this is true, and if it is, you know, where should you buy your plants, and how can you tell?
This is an issue that has come up quite suddenly, and lots of people are looking at this. When greenhouses produce plants, they produce them often with systemic insecticides so that those plants don't have bugs that eat them and devour them, so that the plants will look good, the plants will look vigorous, the plants will have great blooms. You will want to buy those plants because of the great condition that they are in, and to get them in that condition coming out of a greenhouse, frequently they have been treated. Some big box stores are now putting labels into those plants that have been treated with, especially with the neonicotinoid insecticides, because those are systemic and could last. What we don't have yet is a firm understanding of really how bad is this. That if it's a small annual bedding plant that's not going to bloom for a while, the neonicotinoids that were applied back in January and February may have dissipated to the point that it's not going to be an issue. But if you were buying a huge flowering shrub that may store some of that neonicotinoid, yeah, we're going to worry about those flowers containing that insecticide for the next year or two. Well, there's no easy answer, and we're kind of at a catch-22 here. You want good-looking plants when you go to the garden center to buy them, and we know how to do that, but you don't like how we've done that to get them to good-looking so that you'll buy them. It's a bit of a circle right now, and we're getting there. You can ask the retailer if these were treated. If you want to avoid those plants, that's perfectly logical. If you want to buy those plants and nip the flowers off for the next year while the insecticide dissipates from that plant, that would be an alternative. But right now, I'm not sure how big an issue this is, and we just need a little more information to prove that this is the smoking gun that some claim it is. I think the anti-insecticide people are on this quite vigorously, saying, here's the problem. If we just get the neonicotinoids out of the garden centers and out of the greenhouses, life will be good again. I don't expect it to be that simple.
All right, Chris,
that was a long, complicated answer.
Long answer, but does that help you out?
It does. Thank you so much.
All right,
I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for your call. Max is up next in Lee. Hi, Max.
Hi. I heard, I believe it was Mark talking a couple of weeks ago about a chemical, neither a pesticide or a herbicide, that was associated with oak leaf tattering. And I went out and I looked at my oak trees, and lo and behold, I have oak leaf tattering. And my question is, what was the chemical? What can I do about it, if anything? And will it kill the tree?
Well, if you Google oak tatters, University of Illinois, you'll find a study that they did in 2004, and it'll specifically talk. There's a family of chemicals out there, and it'll specifically talk about some of those chemicals that they researched, that there was a connection between oak tatters and those particular herbicides. The good news is, typically, if it doesn't happen every year, depending on your location and stuff, and I've done documentation, a lot of it just depends really what the stage of those leaves are when those certain chemicals are out there, if they get tattered or not. So some years, depending on how much is out there, you may see it, and some you may not. The other thing on your plants is, typically 4 to 6 weeks after they are tattered, they will actually respond by putting a second flush on. The challenge with that is, again, if they do that year after year after year, it can stress them and they can become more susceptible. But if you're seeing a good flush, at least that plant is putting on new foliage that it's going to be able to produce photosynthates for the next year. But there's nothing you can do individually to really stop that symptom from happening.
This is minute amounts of herbicide in the air, right?
Correct.
Yeah, it's not something you did. It's something from who knows how many tens of miles away.
And it's not our typical drift where we see one-sided from things like 2,4-D and Roundup. It's often throughout the plant, even on larger trees. But we continue to try to get some research done and some other things to maybe potentially look at even a difference of a week or 2 weeks in timing on some of these chemicals that might impact some of these plants.
All right, Max, thanks a lot for your call. We'll slip in one more call before the end of the hour. Jim is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. My potato question is, every spring I plant potatoes, and every fall I save a few of those potatoes to use the next year. Is that an okay thing to do?
The only concern there is that if you do that, you may have some disease problems, and they may get severe over time. So usually we suggest that you buy new ones every year, that you buy certified disease-free potatoes, because if you don't, you may be propagating a disease problem, potentially.
Okay. And I have a strawberry question. I pick strawberries. I pick 6 pounds of them, and within 2 hours, I'm home and processing them, cleaning them, and they've not deteriorated a whole lot, but they've started that process. Is there something I can do immediately after I pick them to delay that?
If you can put them in a cool location, that would be the best.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for your call, and we are out of time for this hour. Thank you all so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron, and DNR district forester Mark Vitosh will be back with Horticulture Day again next Friday. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had assistance today from Jason Burns in Ames. Our theme music is composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.